Okay, so the talk we're here for is a very exciting talk. We are many, they are few. It's going to be a discussion of the poet, the British poet, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and the Peterloo Massacre. And we're really lucky to have Moira here this afternoon to give an introduction to this talk. She is from the area where the massacre took place, and so intimate knowledge of kind of the scenes that Shelley would have seen in the She was like accused yesterday, or was suggested that she'd participated in the Lewisham, the Battle of Lewisham. So she definitely wasn't at Peterloo, but nonetheless. So please make Moira feel very welcome.
The Peterloo Massacre of 1819 exposes as a lie the myth that you hear a lot in society, that capitalism equals democracy. Because at the very birth of capitalism and the organised working class, Britain's rulers sought to crush demands for the right to vote, for freedom of assembly, for pay that could feed your family. And the massacre in Manchester in 1819 was a tool that they used to do this. And indeed, the history of capitalism is littered with conscious political massacres of people who have fought for basic human rights. We know that in Australia, the colonisation of this country took place by systematically massacres of Aboriginal people, such as this one at Mile Creek. There were many, many others that are only being revealed in the last few years. 1919 is the 100th anniversary, 100 years after Peterloo, of the Amritsar massacre in India, where the British were determined to try and smash the movement for liberation by massacring people there. In Paris, in 1962, the French government massacred over 300 Algerians who were there demonstrating during the War of Independence for the kind of rights that are denied time and again to Muslims. We hear it today that we need to restrict people's civil rights. Demonstrators in Algeria, in Paris, Algerians, demonstrating for peaceful rights that people take for granted, were massacred by the French government. In Derry, in 1972, 10 Catholics taking part in a peaceful demonstration were massacred by the British army there. And this is a year of anniversaries of massacres. 30 years ago, on June the 4th, the Chinese government massacred the students and workers in Tiananmen Square, demanding their rights. And what these and other massacres have in common is they expose the lie that capitalism equals democracy. And they expose the reality of the brutality of the system in which we live. The other thing that they have in common is that massacres are often hidden, they're often written off as accidents, but also that actually the reality of them are hidden from history. So in the case of the massacre in Paris in 1962, the French government sealed off the city as the Algerians were marching through three parts of the city to the centre. And they only allowed a tiny number of pro-government journalists to report. And the newspapers reported that two people were killed in the massacre, almost by accident. The reality did not come out until the 1990s. In the last few months, we've seen that finally there has been a prosecution coming out of the massacres of 1962 in Derry. Unfortunately, it is one low-level soldier that is being prosecuted for murder, not the butchers of the generals who are responsible. And when I was a little kid, and I used to go to St. Peter's Square, to Central Library, this is the plaque that you still see in St. Peter's Square about the massacre of Peterloo. And I often used to really wonder, why do people call Peterloo a massacre? Because we didn't get taught about it in history in Manchester. Because when you look at that, it tells you that a dispersal took place. And that's the other thing they do with massacres. I really wondered why it was called a massacre. Of course, the reality is, a lot of people used to say 15, most historians now say 18 people were killed, and probably over 600 people were injured as a result of the massacre that take place. Capitalism does not equal democracy. All the rights that we have been granted because of mass struggle or attempts by the rulers to stave off revolution from below. And that the system is forced to operate with granted of rights to us, though those rights are constantly under attack. Isn't it absolutely bizarre that the reaction to Christchurch was to crack down more on civil liberties of people inside of Australia? All the time, what the massacres show us, and why our rulers hide them from history, is that the naked brutality in countries that call themselves democracies, that call themselves civilised, that call themselves sophisticated, that often isn't far from the surface. And the Peterloo massacre took place at the birth of the first working class movement in the world. And it's an absolute demonstration of Marx's understanding of the inherent contradiction that happens in revolutions inside a class society that aren't where the oppressed class are the people who end up in power. That capitalism, having a bourgeois, governments come into power, is a system that right from its birth comes dripping from head to foot, from every pore, with blood and dirt. And the history of the birth of capitalism is that of colonialism, of slavery, of the destruction of the indigenous cultures throughout the world. And in the belly of the beast at the time of capitalism, in the massacre of workers in Manchester in 1819. And the context in which this took place, where these people were slashed with sabres or trampled by drunken militia and then professional soldiers, was a country with an authoritarian state determined to smash growing demands of working people and middle-class people for a better world, a share in the massive profits that were accumulating for the wealthiest in society as a product of the Industrial Revolution. For most of the early 19th century, this was a time of terrible impoverishment, long hard work, six and a half days a week, and terrible living conditions for people in the Manchester area. Britain was coming out of a period of a 22-year war with France that was paid with the blood of working class young men on the battlefield and the crippling taxes of their families. There was mass unemployment, there was hunger, and that shifted an atmosphere of patriotism that had been whipped up in large numbers of the population. The Corn Laws that were introduced at the time put tariffs on imports, and what this did was push up basic food prices at a time when workers were already suffering. Wages had halved since the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and starvation was the norm for thousands and thousands. And the extreme brutality of the authoritarian Tory government at this time was one of the things that really helped radicalise thousands and thousands of people. And I'll talk about the French Revolution a bit as well. But Shelley was one of these people. And if you read his poems such as Queen Mab, which was written when he was 18 years old, Swellfoot the Tyrant and The Mask of Anarchy, which was his direct response to the Peterloo Massacre, all the way through his poems, he rallies against the rich and powerful getting wealthier and wealthier in British society, while the poor get poorer and poorer. So The Mask of Anarchy talks a lot about the poverty and exploitation as a trap that enslaves people inside of capitalist society. As in a cell, for the tyrants used to dwell, so that ye for them are made loom and plough and sword and spade. And in the way that Marx talks about that our humanity is stripped of us under capitalism, that we are made into tools, this is something that Shelley wrote about in the early 19th century. The ruling class responded to the growing demands for change with a system of constant terror that they were trying to impose on people. So they banned trade unionists under the Combination Acts. They repeatedly suspended habeas corpus, which was the legal right to meet, to assembly, to have free speech, to have freedom of the press. They had massive networks of spies in the growing working class movement at the time. They censored the press. They arrested and rearrested radical activists and speakers time and again. And this brutal regime was captured so well by Shelley in the opening of the poem of The Mask of Anarchy. He starts the poem by describing the three leading Tories of the age, Castlereagh, Sidmouth and Eldon. What a bunch they look like. You can see all the class wealth, the privilege and the class hatred in their faces. And he described them as the personification of murder, fraud and hypocrisy. About Castlereagh, he said, he tossed the human heart to chew, to the bloodhounds that he described as following him around. He talked about Eldon's tears for children that turned to millstones as they fell and had their brains knocked out by them. And I really think that often captures what ruling classes are like. They cry crocodile tears for children that they ensured were murdered in the first place. Really evoking the children that were trampled in the Peterloo massacre as a result of Eldon's policies. The ruling class were really terrified at this time, at the growth of the working class movement, and really the enormous impact that the French Revolution had on people of Britain. Just as, you know, we see it all the time in revolutions, they have an impact. 2011 Arab Spring had an echo in the Occupy movements in America, Australia and elsewhere. That despite the repeated shutting down of radical groups, of nascent organisations of working class people, they appeared and reappeared in loads and loads of different forms. And they were absolutely right to be terrified. That since its inception, the British working class were inspired by the French Revolution, by the American Revolution and the Haitian Revolution that occurred afterwards. And it really firmly entrenched the idea that everybody should have the rights that were given to rulers, you know, seen as natural rights from their birth in the movements it inspired. And again, this is really integral to Shelley's vision for a radical transformation of society. His writings are absolutely infused with the potency of revolutionary change. So in Queen Mab, for example, he writes that hope was seen beaming through the mists of fear. It's been delightful writing this as the events in Sudan and Algeria have been going on, actually. These quotes are really great. And in Prometheus Unbound, a poem which I think is wonderful, he talks about the overthrow of kings, producing a liberation where men walked one with the other, even as spirits do. None fawned, none trampled, none frowned, none trembled. So often in life, you want people not to tremble at the authority that is used against them. And Shelley really saw that in the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, etc. And instead, humans that were liberated lived in a world of speaking the wisdom once they could not think, looking emotions once they feared to feel, and change to all which once they dared not be. And working people in Britain had a long tradition of direct action before 1819, from the burning down of Newgate Prison in 1750, which my favourite poet in history, William Blake, was reputedly on the front lines as they burnt down Newgate Prison, to 1811 and 1812, the Luddite Rebellion, a rebellion against the brutal conditions of the factory system that was being imposed. That rebellion was so extensive that 17,000 troops were sent to the north of England to quell it, and it only ended when they publicly hung 17 of the activists. And this kind of ongoing tradition, combined with the new social forces that were brought into life by the Industrial Revolution. So in 1817, 2 years before the massacre, radical politics were really growing in this part of the world, in the Manchester area, and it was organised in what were first called Hampton Clubs and then Union Societies. And these really mushroomed around the Manchester area in particular as the centre of the Industrial Revolution. So towns which I used to spend many time in, such as Ashton, Stockport, Oldham, Rochdale, Middleton, Hyde, Bury, these were all individual little mill towns kind of around Manchester. They all had their own clubs and societies that were formed. And, you know, Manchester was really the first industrialised city of the world. It's the centre of cotton production, and it was the birth of the radical traditions of the new working class. And, you know, there was a chaos about the way the city grew between 1750 and 1850. It's an enormous change in the way it is. And it's kind of what came out of that was all these new leaders of the movement, like Sam Bamford on the right, who was later arrested after Peterloo. He sprang from an anti-war movement that developed again out of the war with France that had finished. And he built really on the anti-wealthy sentiment to develop networks of reformers in every town and growing city in the north of England. The guy on the left, Henry Hunt, is quite a controversial figure. And if you've seen the Mike Lee movie, he's kind of portrayed, I think, in a very one-dimensional way, actually. He was the most famous radical at the time. And he was a very controversial figure. So Sam Bamford, who was a Lancastrian, said of him, he would sell his soul for the cheers of the mob. That was much later. That was in his autobiography 25 years later. And he was like this really famed orator who loved going around, etc. But actually, he was much more radical than loads of the people who saw themselves as reformers in this period, especially coming from the background. He came from a gentleman farmer background. So, for example, he resisted the more moderate reformers who wanted to ask for limited rights to vote for people. He demanded universal male suffrage. And he worked alongside the burgeoning female suffrage movements too. And alongside writers like Richard Cobbett, who organised around the demands of reforming Parliament. And some of the things they asked for, you kind of wish we had today, such as annual parliaments. That would be great. Voting by secret ballot. No taxation without representation, which I would like, please. I don't have a vote in Australia, but I do pay my taxes. And lots of these phrases were absolutely taken from the mouths of the American revolutionaries who had thrown off British imperialism or the French Revolution. The way, you know, some of the slogans being used in Sudan and Algeria today are taken from 2011. And there was really a kind of this kind of to-ing and fro-ing. You know, the Tory government kind of veered between, like, we can't just use repression. We have to try and find ways to co-opt some of the movement. And they tried to co-opt some of the more moderate radicals in what they were doing. But there were also kind of prequels to what took place in the Peterloo Massacre in 1819. So about a year before the massacre, there was this Blanketeers March, which was this proposed walk to London, where people were going to take a petition to the Prince Regent calling for more rights and democracy. And they were going to walk and rely on the generosity of people as they were going. So it was called the Blanketeers March because they were going to have to sleep by the side of the road wearing blankets, etc. And this was led by three teenage agitators. So one of the guys, called John Bagley, had toured towns all round the northwest, around Manchester, where strikes and protests had taken place to build support for this. And there was 30,000 people turned up at the start to take part in this march in 1817, which is massive. Remember, the population of Manchester is about 120,000 at the time. And the military dispersed the crowd and arrested the leaders. At the same time, the Pentage Rebellion in Derbyshire revealed just what having all these networks of spies meant, that every time people tried to organise, you had loads of spies. It reminded me, reading about it, about Ceausescu's Romania, where one in six people were members of the Stasi, the secret police. That's the kind of level. Every meeting you went to, you were being watched by networks of spies who reported back to Eldon and Sidmouth, etc., about what you were doing. And the focus was on parliamentary reform. This was kind of given impetus by the fact that there had been economic struggles in 1817 that were kind of defeated. There were strikes, there was a year of strikes across Lancashire, the county of which Manchester was part, especially among spinners and weavers, against the wage cuts against the rising food prices. And there was some victories, but overall there was a defeat. And that, therefore, the shift became, we're not going to get any further until we change what's going on politically in the system as a whole. And Thompson, E.P. Thompson, in his wonderful book, The Making of the English Working Class, argues that the brutality of the ruling class at the time can be explained by the fact that though on the surface the demand for parliamentary reforms was a constitutional agitation, that really it took place within what was a potentially revolutionary context. One where really, if the old order couldn't be allowed to carry on, if workers weren't going to let them do that. And every single move for rights was met with the brutality of the ruling class at a national and local level. So one of the magistrates who played a key role in ensuring that the Peterloo massacre took place said of radicals who were raising support for the strikers in 1817, "Some of the reformers ought to be hanged, and some of you are sure to be hanged. The rope is already around your necks." There was real naked class hatred of what was going on. And these rounds and rounds of arrests of the leaders, often on really flimsy evidence of these spies, the difficulty for them was juries, who were not made up of ordinary people, actually often failed to convict them, because really things were so bad in society and so polarising that sections of the middle class were really opposed to what the government was doing as well. And despite this, the movement still grew, and these leaders would be arrested and they would come out and they would carry on with their organising. And I love that about reading about working people, is they don't give up, they are resilient, even in the face of repression. And in July, like a month before the meeting took place at St Peter's Field in Manchester, which I'll show you in a minute, James Norris, who was really the most vicious of the Manchester magistrates, said, "The working class are beset by reformers who, by the licentiousness of the press and of their speeches, are incalculating every species of dissatisfaction and even insurrection and rebellion, in which the whole may very shortly end. I fear it is now too late, and that the remedy for the present state of things must be more violent than indictments." And the economic demands that people had were generating these political demands as well, and that's why the movement for suffrage was rising. Paul Foot really argues in his writing that he doesn't, that in our society we often have a separation of economic and political. He argues that at this point those things were much more seen by people as going together. That if they had parliamentary reforms, it would actually help them to have a voice economically. I think it's quite an interesting stuff to read. The major cities of the Industrial Revolution had no representation in Parliament. I think this is one of the reasons it became a focus from people. Since Charles II in the 1680s, no new boroughs had been enfranchised and given parliamentary representation. And if you think about the map of what would happen to the population of Manchester, that it had grown so much, this was a really big deal for people. So Cornwall, which probably didn't have that many people then and still doesn't today, had 44 members of Parliament. I've read this thing actually, that there's this hill in the Cotswold that nobody lived on that had two members of Parliament. Whereas Manchester and Birmingham, the other great city of the Industrial Revolution, had absolutely none. And the scale of the radicalisation was, I think, really, really impressive. So you get these union societies and Hampden clubs that are formed, where people are meeting up, discussing politics. If you don't read, you get somebody to read things to you, particularly Cobbett's Political Register and stuff. And these really, really grow and grow and grow very rapidly. And you also get the all-female society formed in Blackburn, a town about 20 miles outside of Manchester. And the main speaker of that is an Irish woman called Mary Fields, because as we often see, that when people start to rise up, often oppressed people, and Irish people were very oppressed in England at the time, go to the fore of that as well. And really, in the build-up to the Peterloo massacre, it was one of those times where I think people knew something was going to happen. And I'll talk about an example that I was involved in a sec. So in January 1819, Henry Hunt spoke to a meeting of 10,000 in St Peter's Field. There was a meeting in Stockport, which is about 6 miles south of Manchester, of 20,000 people in the June, and 35,000 across the Pennines, 30 miles away, in Leeds. And in July, there was 30,000 people in Birmingham. And the meeting at St. Peter's Fields in Manchester was like the next one of those demonstrations, growing bigger and bigger and bigger, that was going to lead to what's called a monster meeting in London a month later. And you really got a sense, when you read about it, on the one hand, of the movement building to some kind of climatic point. This is not on the same scale, but I really remember the build-up to the poll tax riot in 1990 in Britain, on which 200,000 protesters were attacked by the police on what was a monster march, the day before the implementation of the tax, which represented a massive attack on working people. It was basically, it got rid of, like, what was your rates, where you paid land, you paid according to how big your house was and things like that. And it was a universal tax that everyone had to pay, whether you were rich or poor. And it really represented what Thatcherism was all about. And in the months and months leading up to it, in every town hall across Britain, you saw these kind of protests building up to the big one, including things like occupations of council chambers as they set the tax for that local area. So there was, oh, sorry, I forgot about them. They're the women of the female reform movement. Really great. So there was, this is Hackney Town Hall in East London. There was 10,000 people at the protest when the tax was set in Manchester, 15,000 in Birmingham, and 5,000 in this one London borough of Hackney itself. And there was massive, massive, big kind of barge with the police that night. And really, in the run-up to the big poll tax demonstration, there was a feeling in the air that something was going to happen. Either that there would be some attempt to break the movement, or that it would be the end of the policy and probably the end of Thatcher too. And actually, in the end, it was the end of Thatcher in the long run. And really, absolutely nobody was surprised by the police violence that took place on the poll tax riot on March the 31st, 1990, I think. And you wouldn't find anywhere in British history a document that outlined that this was what the Tory government strategy was, or this is what the police intended to do. But we all knew in that build-up that this was a distinct possibility. And from what I've read about Peterloo, you really get the sense of that in the build-up to the demonstration, to the protest as well. But on the one hand, the organisers of the St. Peter's Square monster meeting were determined for a peaceful protest in Manchester for the right to vote, along the same lines as the earlier ones and the one that was going to take place. And the Mike Leigh film of Peterloo shows really well the way that working class people were organising in the run-up when they've all got all the drillings out on the hills outside Manchester. That really captures the way that the working class movement saw this as a very disciplined stuff. They knew the meeting was going to be massive. They were bringing people from all over Lancashire, and they wanted to make sure that they were represented, you know, in a naive way, but represented in a good way. And Sam Bamford said this about it. "We have been frequently been taunted by the press with our ragged, dirty appearances at these assemblages. We determined, for once at least, these reflections should not be deserved, that we would disarm the bitterness of our political opponents by display of cleanliness, sobriety and decorum such as we had never exhibited before." So that's our side. Our side is determined to be peaceful, organised, sorting everybody out, women and children, everybody on the demonstration. On the other hand, the ruling class was really gambling on Manchester as the place to put a stop to the rising tide of protests and the movement for reform. There was massive unity of people, of the working class across the region, about the issue of parliamentary reform. So there had been like strikes in 1818 of handloom weavers, of weavers organised in factories and spinners, but they'd all been kind of separate strikes. They hadn't really come together. They had sympathy for each other, but there wasn't joint action. But they now came together in this mass movement. And the monster meeting that took place was enormous. Estimates vary, but most historians now say between 60 and 80,000. The population of the whole region was about 200,000. So that's one in three people. I remember the feelings of the anti-war marches in 2003 that were really enormous. That wasn't one in three people, maybe one in five or whatever, one in ten, but not nowhere near this kind of size. And things like the contingent from Oldham, and I'm going to show you a map where these places are in a sec, was led by 200 women wearing white dresses carrying silk banners. The Middleton marchers carried laurels as symbols of peace and friendship. And the Stockport contingent, who had got quite a radical tradition right back to the 1790s, wore the red cap of liberty that was worn by the French revolutionaries, making the explicit connections between what they were doing and the French Revolution. And, there you go, yeah. So this is the different areas that people march from. And I, as a kid, I grew up here. It's like 3.5 miles between the centre of Manchester and Ashton. And Ashton is about 7 miles. It's a bit of a bloody walk. People marched on the day, and like we had roads and everything. And buses. People marched from all these areas to get to the demonstrations. I mean, absolutely. Loads of these areas are really, really hilly. Massive contingents from Oldham and Rochdale in particular. Even Wigan. Wigan's bloody far away, man. It's a long way. And Stockport. Stockport's about 6 or 7 miles. 10 kilometres. Sorry, I keep forgetting that you don't do miles. And as I said, loads of the banners that people carried had the red caps of liberty from the French Revolution on the top. And the banners demonstrated that the protest was about so much more than the simple right to vote. So the Oldham banners said things like universal suffrage, but annual parliaments, no combination act. The Royton banner, which said things like, let us die like men and not be sold like slaves. The Leeds banner said, unite and be free. Saddleworth, which actually people who reenact Peterloo made a representation of this, saying equal representation or death. And really the direction of this, of the political travel of this movement, was universal suffrage. It was building and building, inspired by what had gone on and by the strength of their movements. And the marches to the meeting were absolute festivals of the oppressed. There's this lovely story about the Middleton March, of which Sam Bamford was one of the key organisers, marching down into Manchester through an area called Newtown, where a lot of the poor Irish lived in the most terrible conditions of workers in the area. And they came out to cheer the Middleton contingent. So many marchers took green ribbons to show solidarity with the Irish workers, and some of them joined the procession as well. As I said, most people marched for 3 to 4 hours to get to St. Peter's Field. And while they were marching, the Manchester Yeomanry, who were not like an official police body, I'll talk about them a bit more, they were in pubs in the town, getting really drunk as their preparation for the day. And the regular army, the Hussars, were moving 1,600 troops into position and 2 6-pounder guns. They were hidden from the square, where the protest would assemble. So on the one side, the working class was preparing for this peaceful protest. On the other, the Manchester ruling class had been preparing for the demonstration for months. So the formation of the Manchester Yeomanry took place after the Blanketeers March. And really, it was a private army of the Manchester mill owners. There had been repeated use of the army. After the war happened, there was like 120 places around Britain where the army was now dispersed and stationed, particularly near working class areas. And they were used time and time again against the strikers in 1818. And they harassed meetings that took place across the region, including one in Stockport in February 1819, where they seized the caps of liberty that people had in the meeting. And so this is what it looked like at St. Peter's Square. And you can see that it's really narrow, the streets, to get out of it. And the soldiers surrounded the square. And basically what happened is at 1 o'clock, this is the area. As you can see, it's quite surrounded. There's not much space to get out of the centre of Manchester. The crowd was unaware that the magistrates had ordered the yeomanry to surround the square. And the yeomanry decided, ordered by the magistrates, that they were going to sweep through the crowd and arrest Henry Hunt and the other people that were there to speak at the protest. And as they were charging to do that, a 2-year-old child was killed on the way, a boy called William Fowles, who was knocked out of his mother's arms as the yeomanry, quote, galloped furiously as though they were flying. Of course, when there was an official statement about William's death, how it was described was that he came into contact with a horse and that he fell from his mother's arms. And I really thought about that because Tuesday is the 40th anniversary of the death of Blair Peach, who was a New Zealand anti-fascist in Britain, who was killed by the London SPG, the riot police, on a march against fascists in Southall in 1979. And the report afterwards said that the reason he died when he was clubbed by a member of the SPG, who was never, ever charged with anything, is that he had an unusually thin skull. Aww. And Shelley's poem really captures the violence of the moment. I'll just kind of show you, actually, the kind of events. So I thought this was great, actually. It's just this animation that kind of captures just how big the demonstration was. And that's where the speakers were speaking, and all the banners were brought in from the towns, and people put them around the stage. There you go. And the woman there is Mary Fylde. She was on the platform with Henry Hunt, wearing his white hat that he was very famous for. And that's the hustings. And this is how the Manchester Yeomanry came in to the square, riding quite fast. And he's arrested. They start to seize the flags. And then they start to circle the hustings and attacking the crowds. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. And there's this, you know, obviously everybody runs, tries to get out. There's a pinch point. Loads of people get crushed. There's things like the cellars that people get crushed against, and they kind of fall down into the cellars, and people get crushed underneath the crush of people to get out. The soldiers are surrounding the square. People can't get out. Some of the soldiers join in with what the drunk yeomanry are doing as well. So they're blocked and trapped. And this is what Shelley said about the violence of the moment. Charged artillery drive till the dead seem air alive, with the clash of clanging wheels and the tramps of horses' heels. And at 1:40, so as they charged, they'd had their sabres sharpened in advance of the day, and they had their swords out, and they were going through the crowd, hitting at them. And really, within seconds of the yeomanry charging, people were dead and dying, and screams were ringing out. You know, and I've described how people were killed in the crush as well. One of the famous stories is about an ex-soldier that has been at the Battle of Waterloo, John Lees, who was sabred, truncheoned and trampled and later died of his injuries. And a constable was heard to shout, "Damn your bloody eyes, I'll break your back," as he rode John Lees down. And the story struck a chord with me because it really exposes that myth, doesn't it? Soldiers that go and fight for us are our heroes, and we treat them great. And it made me think about the thousands and thousands of homeless soldiers in Australia, Britain, etc., or the servicemen who fought in Vietnam and Iraq, these heroes who get treated so badly when they are brought home after the war. And there's loads of reports about yeomen searching out individuals they knew in Manchester, because they were like small-time brewers, and they were the direct managers of lots of the workers in the factories. They searched them out to actually go and kill and attack them. And E.P. Thompson says this about it. This panic was not the panic of bad horsemen hemmed in by a crowd. It was the panic of class hatred. Shelley, of course, puts it more poetically. "Let the fixed bayonet gleam with sharp desire to wet its bright point in English blood, looking keen as one for food." The yeomanry had sent their sabres to be sharpened in the months leading up to the massacre. And the historian on Peterloo, Jacqueline Riding's recent book, says she kind of argues that, oh, this wouldn't have happened if it had been the soldiers that had gone in, not the yeomen. It was kind of a drunk moment of madness. Actually, this had been whipped up in the weeks and months in advance. And as people did flee, the yeomanry chased them through the streets as they tried to hide in homes and cellars, and 650 or something like that were injured. And many people didn't seek medical help because they were really afraid of being arrested as they did so. And the response to the massacre was shock and grief throughout the country. All of England knew within 2 days what had happened by word of mouth, etc. And when Henry Hunt, who had been arrested, was returned to London when he was bailed. 300,000 people turned out to greet him when he returned, despite the fear that they would be attacked in the same way. In October, 6 weeks after the massacre, 50,000 people demonstrated in Newcastle. There were subscriptions taken up by working people right across Britain for the families of the dead and injured, especially those who were too injured to work again. And John Lees died of his injuries 3 weeks after the massacre on the 7th of September. And his dad tried to have the inquest turned into a kind of trial of the magistrate's decision, but he was prevented to do so. Nobody was ever charged for what had happened. The magistrates publicly thanked the Manchester Yeomanry for their forbearance. Oh, you exercised such kind of, you know, restraint in what you did. And of course, the ruling class, everybody got together to blame the reformers for their violence. And the ruling class justified their action. This was James Norris, who was the paid magistrate, the kind of chief law and order guy in Manchester. This is what he said. I won't read it. You can read it. So he absolutely justified what happened. Lord Sidmouth thanked the Yeomanry for their prompt, decisive and efficient measures for the preservation of the public peace. And Eldon said that the meeting was a clear act of treason. Absolutely clear that in the aftermath, the ruling class battened down the hatches and they were absolute supporting about it. And of course, they also responded by increasing the level of repression in British society. They introduced the six acts that were used to crush radical activities. So they destroyed the radical press. They speeded up criminal processes. This all sounds familiar. They restricted political meetings to being at a parish level. They introduced transportation for political activity. Britain exported some of its radicals to Australia under that policy. Henry Hunt was sentenced to 2.5 in prison, but actually it wasn't longer because there was such revolt against what had gone on. And massacres often serve to dampen the movement in the immediacy. You get the fear and demoralisation that comes from the scale of brutality. And I think that was certainly the case, you know, when I was when I was 20 and Tiananmen Square happened. And it's the note that Mike Leigh's film ends on. And I was quite frustrated that it ended on that, because on the one hand, it was a really powerful indictment of what the ruling class did in Manchester, the absolute crushing of what took place. But actually, often, massacres become the impetus for those who take up the mantle in the next generation, sometimes even sooner. So Mary Fowles, who was on the platform and was arrested on the day, she was actually sabred as part of this. She survived and she became a leader of the Chartist movement in the 1930s in Manchester. In 1829, when the Duke of Wellington visited Manchester, he was met with hostile crowds who carried placards saying, "Remember Peterloo." When Shelley heard the news, he was in Italy, and he heard the news about the revolution, he described, "The torrent of indignation has not done yet boiling over in my veins. Something must be done. What yet, I know not." I remember feeling like that, actually, when the Tiananmen Square massacre happened. His something was the glorious poem The Mask of Anarchy. There was 91 stanzas. He dashed it off in 6 short weeks. It wasn't actually published till 1832, the year when British workers did actually rise like lions. And the poem is such a great angry tirade against the violence of the rulers, and its rage is astonishing. You get these vivid imagery of the massacres. It's like, you know, in Italy, he has in his head, he can see what's going on. "'Tis to see the tyrant's crew ride over your wives and you. Blood is on the grass like dew." But also, I think the real power of the poem is the description of the potential of humans to rise after massacres and to change the world. And you can see all the way in the second half of the poem the potential of workers if they struggle for freedom. And this, I've really been thinking about this quote, watching what's happened in Sudan, particularly when two dictators went in 48 hours, that tyrants would free like a dream's imagery. Such a beautiful piece of writing. But also, actually, the poem is also very concrete, that freedom is not an abstract concept. He says, "Freedom, thou art clothes and fire and food for the trampled multitude." And as well as the description of the hope, the poem is a real rallying cry for action. That's what we all remember about the poem that Jeremy Corbyn and Richard Di Natale are spotted in my friend's house in North Fitzroy. Is he lecturing leaflet? Is he using it? Let a vast assembly be, and with great solemnity, declare with measured words that ye are as God has made thee free. And it ends with that very famous invocation to rise like lions in unvanquishable number. And at the end, I'm going to get you to all to say it. And I really love the sense of power on our side. But I most love about the poem is the sense of the ease with which the world can be transformed. I know revolutions are processes, and just getting rid of dictators is never the end of the story. But there is that kind of sense of that in the quote, "Shake your chains to earth like dew." That notion that when people rise up, you can get off the chains of capitalism together. So really, just as the 1962 massacre in Paris spurred on Algerians to defeat the French in the Civil War, or Tiananmen Square did lay the basis for the outbreak of the democracy movements and mass worker struggles in the early 2000s, and it's great to read loads of stuff in things like the China Labour Bulletin about young workers who are getting involved in radical politics in China today. Peterloo becomes a spur for future fights, and that really annoyed me at the end of the Mike Leigh film, because I thought it would end with stuff about the Chartists, but it didn't. It just ended with a really powerful scene of John Lees's family after the funeral, but I wanted that as well. And Peterloo was a rallying cry for the Chartists, who in the 1830s became one of the most massive movements where the question of reform and revolution was posed for the first time about, well, can the working class act as a class on its own behalf? E.P. Thompson says 1819 was a rehearsal for the 1830s. And I think it's really important to commemorate those who were butchered in Manchester in 1819 and Amritsar in 1919 and Tiananmen Square in 1989. And Manchester is finally going to get a fitting commemoration this year. This is actually going to be a massive round, kind of, probably the size of this room, kind of platform, and it kind of builds up. And it's going to be a place that people can meet when they're having demonstrations. So that's the kind of, you know, the outline of what it's going to look like. But like the Chartists, like the survivors of the Paris massacre, and the fantastic young students in China today, the point about knowing about Peterloo and knowing about our ruling class and how they behave is to strengthen our resolve to create a world where these massacres become confined to history. And this will only be the case when our side does indeed rise like lions after slumber in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew, which in sleep have fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few. Woo!